Hello and welcome back to the West Photo podcast, produced from the West Photo office in the University of Westminster's School of Arts. My name is Luke Hurlock and this episode I spoke to Mish Gehenna just after his lunchtime lecture as part of the Photo Forum talks here on the Harrow campus. Mishka talks to me about aerial imagery, Tintin books, and his current project using eye tracking technology. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy the podcast. Today we have Mish Gehenna on the West Photo podcast. I'd just like to start by outlining your working practice, how you got started in photography.
Yeah, well, I don't think of myself as a photographer, really. I haven't done for a long time. I came into photography in 2004, I think it was. That's when I realised that maybe there was something there for me to pursue that I might find a voice in or something. And I saw a show at Tate, and it was the first time I'd seen work that was it wasn't kind of expressive in the same way that most of what I thought art was. It seemed to offer a different way of doing things, which rang really true to me, and so that's how I got into it.
Your current project, can you tell me a bit about that? Are you working on anything specific at the moment?
There's a few things. I mean, I'm always trying different things, and I'll be making stuff and then I'll sit on it for ages and come back to it and then try something else. And honestly, there's so many things that I'm trying out, and often they won't work or I'll ditch them. I mean, I can talk about a few things that I'm working on now that I don't know. Well, I know some of them are definitely going to come out because I'm really happy with them. I like the way they're going, and I started working on them a couple of years ago, and I still think they're pretty decent now. And then I'll talk about a few things that I think may be a bit more dodgy. So first thing is something that a title of which I came up with on the train on the way here actually today, which is called, it's called Sight Reading. And basically I bought an eye tracking machine, and what it does is it shows you how your eyes look at a picture, like which parts of the image the eyes are looking at. And what's really interesting about it for me is that your eye is this perpetually moving organ. They never stop moving, and it's hard to believe it, but if you look at it on the microscopic level, the eye is constantly looking for threats and dangers and opportunities and so on. So when you translate that to looking at an image, the eye never takes in the whole image, right? You only look at part of an image at any one time. But if you try to look at the same image twice, that's not possible either, because your eye will take in different information each time. Even if you try and replicate how you looked at something, it's impossible to do because the eye is constantly moving. So what I do is with this eye tracking machine is I look at how the eye moves, and then I create images of the work that I looked at, but only based on what I looked at. So you kind of filter out the rest. So what you're left with is these quite abstract images of a work. It might be the Mona Lisa, it might be an abstract artwork by another artist. But the result is always quite, well, I find it really beautiful, but also quite mysterious. And when you do several captures and you recreate those works, but with those different captures, you see that the existing work becomes an entirely new work just from the act of looking at the work, if that makes sense. Mm. So that's something I've been working on. Quite excited about that because it's very different to anything I've done before.
So when you display that, how do you take out the images, the pieces of the image that you don't look at?
So
do you just black it out or...?
No, I don't. I mean, what I do is I make a copy of the original, and then I encase it in a box that's then laser cut. So where the eye drifted, that is laser cut. So you only see. So the original exists behind this mask. But the only thing that's visible is where the machine has cut away, wherever the eye went. And so they're only like 6-second captures, so it'll be like looking at a picture by Ellsworth Kelly, which is an American painter, and it might be a print or a painting of his. But if I look at it for 6 seconds, then you're left with this. Probably about 50% of the image is looked at and the rest isn't. So you see the 50% of the image through the mask that I looked at that any one time. But when you put three of those together, or six of them together, the viewer kind of has to reconstruct the original picture only based on the fragments of whatever was seen in the first place. It's like a perspex acrylic mask that sits in front of the piece, and you see there's a shadow as well, obviously, of the acrylic doesn't sit on the print; it sits slightly away from the print, so you get the shadow of the mask on the print as well. They're really quite beautiful.
Brilliant. Why the 6 seconds? Why?
Well, it's arbitrary, really, but yeah. it results in a really beautiful form, in a beautiful shape, because when your eye your eye is looking all the time everywhere. Not everywhere, but certain areas. And when you do the capture over 6 seconds, you get this really lovely sort of shape that comes out, that drifts, this kind of form. It's difficult to describe in words, but yeah, I found that works really well.
Are you talking about how, looking back on your work, in your talk you're talking about, you're reading your website and it's sort of about selecting. I don't know. If you've come up with any kind of idea of what kind of stays with you the most, like if you're out of your work.
Well, you certainly know what work made the biggest impact. So, you know, and I've made a number of works that have had quite a big impact in different ways. So, some caused a lot of controversy in the photo world. Others caused a lot of controversy in the food world. In the US, other work made quite a lot of noise in other ways again. I look at some of the work that I've done, and now especially, and think, how did I ever make that? Like, why would I ever do that? How did I get to a point where I made Dutch landscapes, for example? Like, what? I mean, I remember going to a show and seeing the work there and really liking it, but at the same time, it was at the Towner Gallery in Eastbourne. So the Arts Council had bought two pieces of Dutch landscapes for the National Collection, and they included it in a show curated by Brian Cass. And I went and saw the work, and I took my family as well. I had my kids and my partner with me. We drove down to Eastbourne to see it, and I saw the piece on the wall, the two pieces, and it was the first time I've ever looked at my work as if it was somebody else's work, you know. And I was really taken aback by it, because I looked at it and thought, who would make such a thing? It was like a surprising moment. It's like, how did somebody get to the point that they would make that? Why would you do this? A screen capture? How do you get to a point where you decide that doing screen captures is a way of making work? You know what I mean? And it was quite an funny moment. It was like a slightly almost out-of-body experience or something. And I guess that when I said today, didn't I? I think that you look at your website and you think, Jesus, there's so many different projects on here. Where do you begin? How do you begin to categorize them? And why would you as well? And when you work as a photographer and an artist, you're always working on these series. So you have an idea and then you make a series of works about it. But actually, why a series? Why not just one thing that reflects that idea? Why do you need to make multiple, objects that are basically based on one idea. And obviously, as you get older, you just accumulate more stuff constantly, mentally and physically. And yeah, it's just a, you know, funny thing, really.
A lot of your works have relied on kind of using the internet as a resource and pre-existing information that you can kind of access at any time. Do you feel that constant access you could have to potentially making work with all this information that's out there, do you feel compelled to make work constantly because there's just so much that you could use? Or is it just always starts with the ideal and then it's how do I do the
idea? No, it usually starts with, well, sometimes, yeah, it's usually I see something and think, oh, that's interesting. I mean, there's another thing I'm working on, which is I grew up in Belgium, in Brussels, and I left when I was 8. But one of my favourite books were Tintin books when I was a kid. And now I've got 2 young kids. I started buying Tintin books for them, and I'm trying to teach one of them French because I speak French as well. And so I bought the English version and the French version of the same book, Tintin in America. And I noticed that there's an explosion in one of the in the book, and the sound of the explosion is different in the different languages. So in English, the sound of the explosion is boom, but in French, the same explosion is boom. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What is it going to be in a different language again? So then I bought the Spanish version of the same book, and it was boom. So you have boom, boom, and bum. And then I bought the Polish version of the book. Anyway, basically, I ended up buying every translation of the book that I could find. So I got about 16 copies of this same book in all different languages. And I've just taken the explosion, blown it up in every language. And so the sound of the explosion is different in every language. And I've done it with the sound, with other sounds as well, and with other Tintin books. And I find that really interesting, if the sound of an explosion is different in a different in every language, how is that possible? If there is such a thing as objective facts, then surely a sound would be the same in every language, but it's not at all. So that's an example. And that's not from the internet. That's just from, you know, seeing something that I was reading to my kids and deciding that was a subject worthy of exploration. But with the internet, yeah, I mean, it would be like drifting across imagery and seeing something that opens up the possibility of exploring something further. I mean, that's how it works, really. There's no real mystery to it.
Yeah, no, of course.
And it's true, yeah, it is a vast resource. I mean, I often fear that I'm just like an office worker, really, because I'm just sitting at a computer all the time, and I do other things as well, so it's not just that. But I think the internet, there is a danger of that. It sucks you in. It's very seductive like that. You know, you can waste away an entire life on there. I hope that's not what I'm doing.
One of the first podcasts I did this year was with Michelle Henning, and she's been researching in the Ilford's archive, and she said she came across this record of aerial photography, and she had an interesting story about how it was funded and things. But she was saying that aerial photography was used as a kind of way of sort of invading Nepal, because it was a kind of a no-go area in terms of like the British Empire and things like that, but they were using it, using aerial photography to kind of map Nepal without permission and things like that. And I was interested in how you were talking about how aerial photography was interesting to painters, and sort of they'd never seen images like that because previously you'd have to be part of an agency to see it. I was wondering your thoughts on aerial photography and sort of its effect.
So, I was part of a show at the Pompidou a few years ago called The View from Above, and it charted the influence of aerial photography on 20th century art. And basically, there aren't many movements in 20th century art history that weren't influenced by aerial photography in some way. So, for example, you have the supremacists, Kazimir Malevich, for example, who has notebooks filled with pictures he'd cut out from newspapers or pamphlets showing aerial views of agricultural fields, which match precisely some of his you know, compositions with the squares and the rectangles and so on. And then you have the cubists, like I mentioned, Picasso and Braque, who were strongly influenced with aerial photographs of a village that they happened to be staying in that they came across, and so on, and it goes on and on and on, and all the way to the abstract expressionists, who again were influenced by aerial photographs that they'd seen of American agricultural land and so on. I mean, it's shocking, actually, when you see. It's a fascinating show because you realise how something really quite simple as an aerial perspective really came to dominate, was in the background of so many movements in our idea of what art is. And they included Dutch landscapes in that show. And I think what's so compelling about the aerial image is that in a way we get to see the bigger picture, in a way. So, you know, when at altitude, you see things in the landscape that you could never see on the ground. So with my own work, when I was really interested in the challenge of photographing huge infrastructure using aerial imagery, because obviously from a satellite's perspective you can capture an entire oil field, and not only that, but you can see the whole infrastructure, you can see the circuitry of how things work, you can see where the petrol comes out, where the oil comes out of, you can see the pipelines that it goes down, that it goes through to get to the oil containers, to then get to the storage tanks, to then get to the refineries, you know what I mean? You see all of it. You see an entire thing, which again on the ground is impossible to see. And so for me, that was a really fascinating way of working. Also, the other thing is there's no horizon line, right? So you are at the perspective of either falling to Earth or being suspended just above the Earth looking down. And it's a very... I really love the metaphor of that, because I think the idea of traveling to other planets now is really, I think our generation is kind of confronted with the fact that we are stuck here, and if we can't make it work here, we're screwed. And I think that perspective of looking back at Earth, you know, which so a lot of my work has, in that sense has done, I think it's very much part of that. It's part of that trend of realizing that, you know, this is it. This is what we have. We're not going to go anywhere else. Whereas if you think about the 60s and 70s, you know, it seemed like a very real possibility, a utopian dream that, well, we got to the moon, the next stop is Mars. And, you know, by 2001, you know, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, we'll be traveling to other planets, you know, and that will be the norm. But actually, that's not true at all. So I think in that sense, it's maybe interesting to me, the whole that's something that the aerial views offers.
I was just wondering if you have seen any work that you've liked recently that's kind of stuck in your mind, or B, if you want to talk a bit about the Cruel and Tender exhibition that you say kind of got you into your kind of interest in images and things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've just watched a brilliant documentary called Burden, which is about the life of one of my favourite artists, Chris Burden, who was started out as a performance artist in the 1960s in America, and ended up working much more as a sculptor, really. But they're just slightly crazy projects, sometimes working with photography. I mean, the documentation of the performances was always photography for the most part, or film. Well, that's a brilliant really interesting. That's fascinating life, fascinating character, brilliant work, really interesting work, really challenging. He would do things like he would take he realized that he could basically go to a television channel in the backwater of LA somewhere where he was living, and so they would be it would be like a cable channel, and their late night slots, you could get advertising on a late night slot for like nothing, right? So not nothing, but a few hundred dollars, so far less than, you know, renting out a venue to do a show. And so he would make these like 30 second ads that would be broadcast to people, whoever was watching TV at that time of night. So one of them pieces he did is he's naked and he's crawling through glass towards the camera, and it's dark, and you just hear you see his body. It's black and white, it's a bit of a crap image. It's not very sharp, but I mean, it doesn't matter. You see him crawling through this broken glass, and it obviously hurts. And he's crawling towards the camera, and then it just cuts to Chris Burden, and that's it. And then it goes back to like a shampoo commercial. So you can imagine. And these ads were in between shampoo commercials and car commercials, right? So you can imagine somebody sitting there at midnight eating God knows what on the sofa, just watching telly, and then there's a commercial break, and suddenly you get Chris Burden crawling through glass towards you. And I just... And then there's other pieces he makes, like... well, one of my favourite pieces is... he's on Laguna Beach in Los Angeles, and it's just a photograph of him firing a pistol at a 747 that's taken off from the airport. And basically, the bullet will never reach the plane because the plane's travelling too fast and Burden's too far away. But the act... it's such a shocking gesture, and it's an amazing photograph. But the fact that he would do that is so shocking and outrageous. But at the same time, it's kind of like man against machine, an individual against a system, you know, a very sophisticated system. There's just something so pure about the gesture and shocking that I think that is an amazing, it's one of my favourite pieces. And it's so simple, you know. He was really... influenced by minimalism, you know. It's kind of minimalist conceptualism almost. It's like the idea, the gesture, and they're funny as well. A lot of the pieces, there's this kind of dry humour, sardonic humour, and I don't know. And it doesn't look like any art of the time either. It looks like it's very fresh, and I think even today you look at this work and it seems very fresh. And I think that's something that I think about a lot, and I've really enjoyed watching that film. It's a brilliant film. I forgot what the second part of the question was.
Oh yeah, well, the cool and tender.
Oh yeah, the tea. So basically, well, just following on from Chris Burden, you know, there's a whole, I think, when you don't know much about art, and you have all these ideas about what art is, I think the cliche, really, the tendency is to think of art as people like spilling their guts out, you know, being really expressive, expressing themselves and letting the world know what they think about things. You know what I mean? Like that for me was a cliche of what art was. And when I went to Cruel and Tender, it was the first time I really saw art that was against that. It wasn't really about that anymore. I mean, okay, Nan Goldin was in there, and there's a lot of that in her work, I think. But there was a lot of other work that was much more quiet in a way. Yeah, I think maybe that's a good word. But the gestures were really epic. And so they're like, when I think of Burnt and Hill of Becker's work, you know, that's incredibly dedicated work in which, you know, the effort that goes into it isn't reflected at all in the images, because they're such simple images, really, such simple pictures, but obviously scratched the surface, and they are, there's so much that went into making those, but they're very quiet images. They say so much without, you know, shouting it out. And I think when I realised that art could be like that, it kind of changed my life, really. I sort of thought maybe that's... well, I just felt very comfortable with that, in a way. I felt like this was something for me, you know. I grew up in a pretty dramatic household, so I always ran away from that, in a way. And, finding that there was a place where this quiet work could take place, you could still say some very big things, some very important things about... You could say some important things about big things, right? Geopolitical things, or an entire culture, or, you know, whatever. There was a way to do that without falling for the cliche of what art and artists should be. That, for me, was a massive deal, really. And it coincided with meeting artists as well, who I ended up working with for years and still have really good relationships with to this day. And obviously I learned a lot from them, and it carries on.
Thank you very much to Mishka Henner. You can find all our episodes with links to our guest websites online via iTunes by searching for The West Photo Podcast. Once again, if you want to get in touch, just email info@westphoto.pictures. Thank you very much for listening.